This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
There is a queer angle to every issue, and we will find it. Don't expect us to be nice. Don't expect it to be safe. And don't expect us to be politically correct. Nothing is sacred. We find the queer, profane, and cringeworthy wherever we can, here on Joy 94.9. Is nothing sacred?
Hi there, Joysters. You're on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. And thanks, Sammy, for the wet spot. Another great show tonight. And listeners, we want you to interact tonight with tonight's program. So don't forget, it's on air at joy.org.au if you want to email in. Or it is 0427-JOY-949 if you want to text in. Or you can ring Hannah on the front desk and she will take a message for us. Hello, Hannah.
She's sending us kisses.
That's good of her. She's got fabulous nails tonight. They've got little dots all over them. And we've got a big show today. We started off the day with virtually no guests because we've all been too lazy during the week to organise anything. And we've got a packed out show tonight. We've got three very diverse guests. And in the studio with us at the moment, we've got Clovis Palmer from the Burnett Institute. Hello, Clovis.
Hey,
are you here? Yes.
Thank you.
And we've got Ian Muchmore from Living Positive Victoria. You here, Ian?
Hello, Jim. Not seen you in a while.
Oh, no, at least 5 hours. and we're going to have a bit of a discussion with Clovis and Ian about science communication. Where is HIV science going? And as you know, we've had a sort of recurrent theme through our show over the past couple of years about HIV and what it all means to all of us. And it means different things to each of us around the room. And so we are going to have a bit of a talk to them. And then later in the show, we're going to have a discussion with one of the hosts of our sister program, Worldwide Wave, which is on Tuesday nights at 7, is it? Sometime on Tuesday nights, anyway. So we've got Dean Galloway coming in, and we're going to talk about where the world is in terms of LGBTI politics, country by country, and whether or not having a Daniel Andrews Labor-led government in Victoria is actually progressive or not in those terms. So let's get straight into it. So welcome, Ian and Clovis. Now, Clovis, you are a researcher at the Burnett Institute, aren't you?
Yes.
And what I want to talk to you tonight about, where is HIV research going, and particularly in relation to cure or vaccine?
Yeah, well, over the past decade, since the news about the Berlin patient, Tim, first person who was cured of HIV, there has been a surge in interest regarding finding a cure for HIV. So in the past, people used to be very touchy, and they're very skeptical about cure research, and even to call the word cure, it was very difficult for the scientific community.
Historically, have we cured viruses?
So we have cured some viruses, yes. And if you follow, for example, the hepatitis C research, there have been quite substantial gain in that area recently. So we can cure viruses. So I don't think we should shun away from trying to cure HIV.
And if we believe tonight's news, we are about to cure Hep B as well.
Yeah, so again with the different hepatitis strains, there have been enormous research and
but they don't mutate like HIV and the retroviruses do they?
So that's the most stunning thing about HIV, that it mutates very rapidly. So therefore it evades the immune system easily. Hence it's very difficult to find vaccines against HIV. But to touch on regarding where the field is going, I think it's safe to say over the past few years, there have been a substantial amount of deal regarding whether or not, you know, people have been cured or, you know, baby have been cured. And one of the things that a lot of people don't understand is that we don't have a way to actually determine whether or not an individual is, so to speak, cured because of the lack of methods to test HIV reservoir in these people.
So the cure will really demand that we find a way of chasing HIV virus out of all the reservoirs where it may be hidden in the body.
Well, I think what I understand from what I've heard Sharon Lewin talk, one of the things we need to think about is a definition. That's what scientists would say, is whether we talk about a sterilizing cure, so a cure where every trace of virus within the body is eliminated, so that would be a sterilizing cure, and that's traditionally what we would think about as a cure from a an infection. But we might also think about a functional cure?
Functional cure,
Clovis.
And what's that? Is that where we
so
get
a
down
functional
to
a cure, Clovis, would be where, for example, we have some evidence that treating people very early with antiretrovirals may reduce the amount of latent virus. So latent virus is virus that's hiding in the body, and if we could reduce that to a very low level and the body could cope with that, that may never come back even if they're not taking drugs. Now that's very, very early work at the moment.
Doesn't that assume that the immune system is going to be undamaged and is able to deal with that amount of virus? Because obviously the immune system in some people must knock out the virus, otherwise lots more people would
be... Well, it's been a long time since I've been a medical researcher, although I was 25 years ago, actually, a medical researcher, and I even published in Nature, believe it or not. So I don't know the answers to all of those questions, but I think when we think about a functional cure is thought to be much more practical and realistic than a sterilizing cure, which may be really very, very far away. I'm a little bit more skeptical, I think, than Clovis is about whether we're going to see a cure and what a cure may look like. And that comes from having been in that medical research area and seen how what we often call breakthroughs, I hate that word, but breakthroughs in medical research are translated into medical outcomes which actually benefit people. And I go back, say, 20, 25 years, and I had a mate I went to uni with, and he discovered one of the people that actually couldn't be infected with HIV. And when I sat down with him actually 25 years ago, I didn't believe him, I'll be honest. I was a bit of a skeptic, so that's just not possible. Of course, he was right, and I should listen more. That ended up with a huge paper from the Aaron Diamond Research Center. And 25 years later, we now have a new class of drugs based upon that work, which is just being tested at the present time. So that's how long a piece of science typically can take to actually go into the field. It can take several decades to actually translate and make a huge benefit for people. And I'm utterly confident that we're going to see those breakthroughs, but when they happen, I'm not sure. And how long they will take to translate, it could be decades.
One thing that I'm curious about, I saw an article in Time magazine recently about San Francisco aiming to be the first, I think what the phrase they were using around... AIDS-free city, and the way that they were defining that was saying there will be no new infections in San Francisco. That's their goal.
And well, one of the things that happens, I was looking at that data actually from San Francisco only a couple of days ago, and one of the things that's still shocking in San Francisco is the number of cases of AIDS, not of HIV, but the number of people dying of AIDS. I don't have those figures right in front of me, but I remember that they were in the hundreds or the thousands. And that illustrates what we need in an HIV cure is we don't just need the science. We need it to be affordable, and we need a health system.
We need good policy that delivers.
And there is no public health system in the US. So that's why many people are not even on treatment, and many people in the US, thousands of people in the US are still dying of AIDS in the world's supposedly most developed country.
But you know, even in a country like the UK, which does have a health system and has the NHS, they're still one of their big problems, because I just came back from the UK, and one of the big problems they've got there is the rising number of late stage presentations of AIDS that they're getting.
Yes.
And so they're not actually finding those, they're not actually searching out and finding the cases of people with HIV, yeah, living with HIV in their community.
So when we think about a cure...
Step one is finding everyone.
Well, I don't want to be a skeptic, but I think we need to balance what's happening at the present time and probably for the next 10 to 20 years about what we need to do to deliver the science that we already have. And we know that there are something like a million people
but
a year.
But I think also before you think about the cure, so to speak, we need to develop new techniques and the methods so that we can able to test these individuals. So we don't want to say, you know, somebody is cured or this individual has been in remission, and then a next year or two the virus reappears. So first of all, we need to get methods developed.
But hasn't that exactly what has happened with these last couple of so-called cures, that the people that were so-called cured have come out of remission?
Yeah, exactly, because most of these tests that we are using or which are available to us, you take a sample of blood from the patient and we analyze to see whether or not they have integrated DNA in the immune cells. But more and more studies have been shown that the virus also infects cells within the brain, within the gut, liver, and testes as well.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
We're talking HIV science and the participation of the community in HIV science and things like that. Ian, is there good participation of the community from Living Positive Victoria in scientific...
Oh, I think something that the scientific community is really being excellent about is realising that engaging with positive people is going to be central to finding this cure. I mean, I think everyone thinks we'll get there eventually, but there are some... I think positive people are being involved at a very early stage. There's a new project being set up by Sharon Lewin, now at the Doherty, and that has good involvement from the National Association of People Living with HIV. REO Brent Allen's on that as well. I think there's a real conversation going on there. And some of the things they've identified is that we actually need to go out and communicate better.
Clovis, are we all in competition for this? Who's going to win?
We'll never be in competition. I think one of the things, even though Sharon has left the Burnet, we have a very tight collaboration going on. So personally, she and I, we have a very interesting collaboration looking at how we could use metabolic drugs to sort of dampen the reservoir or sort of try to deplete the reservoir. So I think it's a win-win situation.
But, I mean, that does raise a really interesting question, doesn't it? The dampening the reservoirs or chasing the virus out of the reservoirs. I mean, I'd like to ask as a positive person, why would I do that? You know, I mean, I sort of intrinsically think that, and this is completely wrong scientifically, but I sort of think that if the virus has managed to hide itself away inside the body somewhere, then... You know, there is some evidence, isn't there, that the virus now is not as strong as the virus when it first emerged, that it's actually a weaker virus now. And that
No, it can actually be stronger. The thing is that we have the antiretroviral drug suppressing it. So as soon as you stop taking your drugs or you miss a few dose, then it reappears.
So that if you're a positive person and you stop taking your drugs so that you chase it out, because that's what will have to happen, to chase it out of the reservoirs, people will have to stop taking their antiretrovirals, won't they?
Yeah. Well,
there's a bunch of conditions. I mean, this is why the bar is pretty high, because we have lifelong treatment with antiretroviral drugs, which most people in Western countries with health systems, all those caveats, can take, and they're really basically going to live something like a normal lifespan. But if you want to trump that with an HIV cure, it's going to need to be presumably cheaper, well, at least for the public health point of view. The drug company might want it to be more expensive.
You're talking about treasury now.
Yeah, okay. But you want something that's going to need to be safer. It's going to need to be more effective, have fewer side effects. There's a whole bunch of things which will need to do to be better than the current treatment. And one of the things that positive people need to be involved in is in the clinical research, which will help deliver that. And I'm absolutely confident that we will deliver that. But there are risks involved in that. And ethics committees will have a whole party about whether it's right for positive people to participate in something which might put themselves at risk. Now, I think that if positive people are fully informed, if we have these conversations, anyone who has a medical condition or an infection, doesn't really matter whether it's HIV or not, if they want to participate in research and they think that's going to be good possibly for future generations, they should have that opportunity to consent to that.
Can I ask an ignorant question? So in terms of the risks, once someone, if they do go off the antiviral drugs and then back on them, does that, what impacts does that have? Could someone participate, say, for a few months? If they then go back to the normal medication, will their health return to the previous health or
I
not
think
necessarily?
What it means is I'm not an expert in clinical trial design. I remember looking at a bit of the Varinostat study that was conducted about a year ago. Those clinical studies need to be designed quite carefully such that it really does minimize the risk for people living with HIV. So if they do come off treatments, they're very closely monitored.
Yep.
But I don't think that was happening in the Varinostat trial. In those very early studies, which are just looking at safety, you're really going to want to do as little as possible to put someone at risk.
As Ian said, in most of these studies, well, in all of these studies that have been done so far, the patients were still on ART, antiretroviral therapy, along with the Varinostat, for example. So it's a combination of ART plus other interventions. So it's not a matter of taking the patient off the drugs and then, you know, putting them on something else. They will still remain on ART.
So, well, you know, as a former bureaucrat and policymaker in this area, one of the things that I always found the hardest to deal with was actually getting decent mental health services for people with HIV. And it seems to me that one of the big issues here is going to be what happens when with the mental health implications of all of this, because I suspect that the sort of things you're talking about, Ian, will lead to some fairly significant questions around mental health and whether or not we've got the right services in place to support people through
possibly
mental health.
I think there are social issues to what a cure would mean. And again, I think that the conversations are starting and the biomedical scientists are realizing that they need to work with the social scientists. And I'm aware that there's some conversations going on saying, well, what would a cure mean for us as a society? What would it mean for positive people if we were to wipe out HIV? If you used to live with HIV, but you no longer have HIV because you've been cured, does that make you a positive person? Are you still living with HIV, or have you been removed from that community now? And presumably this cure will be more effective or available to some people before it is for other people. And we think of ourselves as strong as a community. So I think there's some really deep thinking that will eventually need to happen about what a cure will mean for us as a society. But the beauty is that we're now beginning to think of that in a holistic way and in a joined-up way, which is not just about a biomedical intervention.
And listeners, if you've got any comments to make on this, please email us in onair@joy.org.au or SMS us on 0427JOY949 or ring Hannah on the front desk and tell her.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Your Honour is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. Come on, listeners, somebody must have a question about this. We're stunned that nobody's bothered to raise any issues with us tonight in the studio, because this is a really interesting discussion about...
Where are you, Scotty? Scotty...
Yeah, you know, usually...
Nurse James? Our favourites?
No, I know what Nurse James is up to tonight, so we won't go there. And... but anyway, onair@joy.org.au, send us an email and tell us you're listening, or 0427JOY949
I have a question that someone for Clovis.
Go on, Ian.
I think, did we just pay a fraction there from a service announcement, I think, from Positive Women? And so I think one of the things people would ask is, how will this cure research affect women? Because often what happens in these type of studies is that we don't do the research on women because we're concerned about reproductive effects.
Oh, no, because they menstruate, women, so they're abnormal.
Yeah. So will women get a fair crack of the whip in this cure research?
Yeah, I think so. And the NIH in America, they have now a policy that we have to include certain minority groups and women
But women are not a minority.
Minority in terms of HIV infection.
Well, not globally, they're not.
Like in America, women are the minority group for HIV. So, I think all will benefit in the long run.
But often what happens in drug trial research is that women are not tested at an early stage, and children as well too. Yeah. Children are often the ethical issues of conducting that research is more difficult. So we need those groups to be serviced by this.
We have actually showed.
Let me tell you a funny story about children and drugs. When I used to work in the College of Physicians, the paediatricians used to say that they would ring vets and ask them what dosages they gave to certain weight dogs before they would bring an adult physician and ask what dosage they should give a child, because what happens in dogs is more likely to reflect what happens in children than what happens in adults.
Well, I guess this is one of the challenges, isn't it, in the pharmaceutical industry more broadly. If children are not included in trials, and therefore there's no data, and therefore we don't know what
ethical issues
safety.
About including children in trials.
Of But it's the same with, this is totally going off track, but things like drugs in breast milk. And so then you end up with people not breastfeeding because of the concerns about drugs, which may be completely unfounded.
Can I spin off?
That's my two cents.
Can I spin off an even further tangent? Because what we're talking about here is sort of like the rumours that we hear about science and how we act upon those and how they affect our behaviour. So we were talking, Clovis and I were talking about what are some possible risks or what might happen if we believe that we have a cure before we don't have a cure. Now, what we've seen, I've been involved around genome science and stem cell science for years, and we were worried there that we were overhyping the science. Yeah. And what we're now seeing around stem cell science is that people with terminal illnesses are going overseas to get these supposedly magical stem cell therapies. Sometimes they're just innocuous and they just take, you know, all their life savings away and they have to mortgage their house. But other times they actually harm them. And one of the fears might be, how much do you feel about this, Clovis, that what we'll see is that people will go overseas because they'll hear a rumor that this will work for their child or there's this new therapy out there. And certainly you see a lot of that medical tourism. If people have the money, they will go and spend that money, and the science may not be there to say.
I'll tell you what's even worse than that, Ian, and this has been, I've noticed this on some of the online petition sites just lately, where there've been petitions saying my child has this thing. And there was actually one in Victoria just recently, and it was a petition to the new Premier of Victoria to get him to release some treatment through the Children's Hospital for some child who'd been announced as being incurable. The disease was incurable, and they wanted some untested treatment brought in from overseas to be run through the Children's Hospital. And so they were getting a petition up through change.org or one of those things. And those petition sites are actually incredibly powerful, but if they're not monitored properly or not moderated properly, they're incredibly dangerous, because this is the sort of social media pressures that will be put on governments to change policy and make policy that's got no evidence behind it and is really badly informed policy. But once governments fall for that pressure, which they will do eventually because there are votes in it, we might as well just throw the science out the window.
Well, that's why I think education is important. And as Ian said, we have to learn how to translate the science into layman's language so that people realize that there's no cure for HIV.
Yeah, and I don't think we've done... I think there's further to go. We desperately need people like Clovis who can help us communicate this science and have the conversations about what's possible now, why we need the involvement of both positive people and negative people in medical research. And Victoria traditionally has, you know, led the way in medical research. And if, you know, it's quite reasonable to expect a cure for HIV to come from Victoria.
It's also Absolutely. Quite reasonable to expect research institutes to employ scientific communicators, isn't it?
And I think that's happening. And I think
people
there's a real engagement.
People who can take scientific research. We, in fact, interviewed somebody on this program once whose job was writing PR articles for scientists in the Department of Environment, I think it was, where they would go to the researchers in the Department of Environment and say, is this what you wanted to say? And then give it to them in plain English, and the researchers would go yes or no. And sometimes it was the first time the scientists had actually heard the research presented back to themselves in plain English.
So sometimes I think people think that if you're talking about HIV the whole time, what's special about HIV? What's happened
Nothing.
Around HIV and medical research is that previously around how we conducted clinical trials, and I think HIV cure research also has the potential to do that, is to change how we conduct medical research, and is to involve people who are affected by the condition much more. So it's not just about HIV. Yeah. If we can get this right, we can really engage people, we can deliver new therapies quicker.
And I just wanted to ask, I've been sitting back and just listening because, you know, I feel like there's so much I'm not aware of in the subject. So I guess I'm the layman in this instance. But I just listening to all of the different elements of research and speaking of a cure, I suppose for the AIDS conference that was recently held in Melbourne, is that a tool that's used to bring all of these together and try and have an overarching strategy? Because it does sound like there are so many different moving parts and that there is different things going on in San Francisco and Melbourne. And, yep. and of course, there's a difference between countries such as Australia and African countries. I'm just sort of thinking, is there any continuity? How do we bring this all together?
Yep. So that's exactly the purpose of these large conferences like the AIDS conference and the International AIDS Society conference as well. To share knowledge and ideas from different groups, organizations around the world. Some things that might fit the cap in Australia might be different in, for example, Africa or Central America. So it's a nice way to dialogue and communicate between scientists, advocates, and everybody. Yeah.
And what was your experience? Because were you both at the conference?
Yes, yes. I mean, I think there was
Clovis wrote one of the best blogs in the conference, yeah, in my opinion. It was more informative than virtually any of the official communications. Well,
thanks for that.
it was good, and I said we need more of that. I mean, I think one of the things that's missing in some of the media coverage is that we basically lost almost all medical writers in Australian media. That's maybe just a couple of science writers now. We've probably got Sophie Scott on the ABC and a couple of other people. But what that means is that the medical stories that are put together in a press release is basically what gets out in the newspaper or what's on the radio story. So we miss a lot of the nuance, or we miss the scientific debate, yeah, and the questions that need to be asked about a particular study. And we need things like blogs, the sort of work that Clovis is doing. There's some great people within the positive community as well who are writing about this cure research and really opening it
and
up.
That's
and
why
it more
we will
accessible.
Go on having you guys back in the studio on a fairly regular basis.
And we'll be back.
Absolutely.
I'll be happy for that.
We also have a message. Thank you very much for messaging in. Our messenger says, I've been HIV, I think they mean HIV positive, for 15 years. I'm from Brooklyn, NYC. One thing, being positive for years, I have my highs and lows. One major thing is that has physically and mentally helped me is working out. That's good. I look forward to a cure. The stigma in the US is worse than the disease. Very interesting.
And we must look forward to a cure.
Thank you so much for messaging in. I hope that means that they're messaging from America. That's very exciting, if that's true.
Wow. It's very international.
Wow, international guests. Very exciting. We do have to... We have sadly run out of time, but thank you so much for talking with us.
It is from America. It's an SMS from an American number.
Yes.
That's very, very exciting. International listeners, thank you very much for messaging. And thanks again for coming in. We look forward to having you back on the show very shortly. It's 24 minutes to 11. You are on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
You are Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9, and it is 10:41, and we've had a bit of a cracker of a show tonight. I was going to say we're going to have a change of pace now, but we're not going to have a change of pace. We're going to have a change of topic. And we've got in the studio with us now Dean Galloway. Hello, Dean.
Hello, Jim.
And Dean is one of the co-hosts of one of our sister programs, and we call World Wide Wave a sister program because we think they think like we do. So we like that.
I just like that you say that we think. That's flattering in and of itself, I think.
Well, you do think occasionally. You get it wrong occasionally, but most of the time you get it right.
Oh, thanks, Jim. That's great.
And World Wide Wave goes around the world one country at a time, I think, is their tagline. One country at a time, looking at issues around LGBTI progress, rights, life, etc., etc., etc. And we're up tonight. We're going to give them a special little 5 minutes of World Wide Wave now. Then we're up to Victoria. Have you done Victoria before?
As a state?
Yeah, as a little country.
No. No, definitely not. That's
well,
too dull.
We've got to Victoria. I'm going to ask you the question. Is having an Andrews Labor government a step forward or not?
Couldn't you ask me about Gambia or something I do know about? Well, I don't know. I mean,
no, Mount Gambier is over the border.
Look, we were talking about this before the show, and I think that it's harder for...
You're giving away our radio secrets now.
We are. It's sometimes this preparation sometimes, listeners. Look, I think it's more challenging for small L Liberal parties to govern because they have to appeal to a broader range of voters. They still have to appeal to business, but they also have to appeal to,
Lefty Pinkos.
Lefty Pinkos.
Another one of our sister shows.
That's it, right after our show on Tuesdays. So, given that Labor, I mean, they haven't been great for, say, marriage equality, but they've been a lot better than the Coalition have. So I think from our perspective, if you're focusing on LGBTI rights as opposed to financial matters, then I would say it's a positive step.
They have got a Minister for Equality who we have asked onto the show, and we're hoping in the next few weeks we may get him on the show. So that'll be interesting.
They're probably a bit busy at the moment, but yeah.
They are very busy. Apparently they've been going from sort of 6:30 in the morning onwards doing briefings and things like that. And the Minister for Equality is also the Minister for Water, Planning and Mental Health and something.
I wonder which one will come first.
Disability. Mm-hmm. So he's got mental health, disability, equality and water and housing, I think he's the Minister
for. Quite a lot on his plate.
It is. He'd have a lot of advisors up there. So
do you think we'll come first?
Let's hope so.
Well, we're going to be equal, so we will see, won't we?
So I guess to shift more internationally, what have been some of the big ticket items on the international stage?
Yeah, are we getting better issues internationally or worse?
That's a really good question. That's probably the question that we ask ourselves every week on World Wide Wave. I would say we are getting better. There are 79 countries where homosexuality is illegal in some way or another. I think there's about...
Illegal.
And there's about 14, I think, countries where it's punishable by the death penalty. However, the same-sex marriage is legal now in, I think, 13, 14 countries as well. So, and I think just
and the
this
world
year,
hasn't come to an end.
That's true. That's true. Oh, and actually, it's more than that. It's about 17 or 18 countries have same-sex marriage now. So
including,
18,
including
that's
a
it.
Lot of Catholic countries.
Yes. Ecuador, Brazil, Spain, Uruguay. That's it.
France.
It's quite surprising. So, do you know about how sort of marriage equality was achieved in that kind of climate?
There's a lot of men in dresses in those countries.
I think that's not just the only reason. I think it's because, for example, Spain was under Franco's jackboot until, you know, and then the fascist party until, what, late 70s, early 80s. Mm. And they tried a coup and it didn't work. And since then, Spain has been particularly, wanting to, you know, been particularly progressive. They've had enough of being, you know, oppressed. Other countries... every country is different. It varies. So the first country was the Netherlands in 2001. And second was Belgium shortly after that. And it is mostly
Belgium
Europe.
Is mostly a Catholic country.
That it's interesting that these countries... I think there's a strong... You'd have to say that in those countries, most of them, there's a fairly strong separation between church and state. So that seems to be, you know... On the other hand, you've got Africa, which has 53 countries and... Same-sex marriage is legal in only one of them, which is South Africa, or at least civil partnerships and things like that. And in fact,
that's not quite right. I was reading the other day in the New York Times that I think it's Gabon or Mali or one of those odd nations in the middle, sort of surrounded by Islamic countries, doesn't have an illegal status for homosexuality. And the president has actually announced that he's not going to do it. He's not going to fall into line.
Yeah, Mali's in the north and it might be Mali. They're pretty friendly. I can't remember which one it is. But in most countries in Africa, we are not welcome.
Just wanting to... Sorry, I've been absent from the show forever behind the panel, but it's Patrick here. I was just wanting to look at when you are looking at a term like marriage equality, which... is in itself a loaded term, because are we looking by marriage equality by just same-sex attracted people? Are we also including people who are transgender as well? And also, that doesn't, does it incorporate, is it just monogamous relationships? Is that what the only concept of marriage is?
I think in all of these countries, you'd have to say that it would be monogamous relationships.
Monogamous relationships.
Or, you know, there would be no polygamy that would be legalised that I'm aware of.
New Zealand is the odd one out, isn't it? Where in New Zealand, it's between two consenting adults. And so that, you know, we've got a famous case, a famous Victorian case of an intersex person and her wife, who we've had as guests on this show, Tony
The wonderful
Briffa,
Tony Briffa.
Who married in New Zealand because they could. But they wouldn't be able to marry in most countries under the same-sex marriage laws because they're not same-sex.
We also have you also have something interesting in Australia, of course, where you have someone like Senator Janet Rice. Her wife, they were married before her wife transitioned. So her wife is a trans woman. So therefore, they're actually legally married because there's nothing to kind of separate that out. But at the same time, then, if someone had been transitioning, it's, do you go by what they were born with, or what they are, or what they're assigned with as birth? Sorry, I'll just need to correct myself there. Or what their sex is to them. So you've got that part too. Because, you know, I don't know which countries this is, but isn't there certain countries where homosexuality is illegal? So therefore, now forgive me, some men transition to women. Now, this isn't generally how transitioning works, but Iran. Thank you. I didn't know where it was. I was about to say Iraq, and I thought that's wrong. I know that's wrong, but that's how they get through it.
And they were forced into it by a fatwa by the Ayatollah Khomeini, in fact, that said that it was okay for them to do that.
I suppose what the lessons we learn is that every country is different and has its own peculiarities.
There's a thing called culture that needs to be taken into account when we start making these demands.
That's it, and that's why I would say that things are improving, because before 2001 there was no same-sex marriage of any kind anywhere, whereas now there is movement. I mean, also there's other countries where certain states have same-sex marriage, like Mexico. The United States is probably the most famous one, where, you know, recently there was a court case and five states had to legalise same-sex marriage in the space of a few days. So there's been a lot of movement over there. Yeah, it's just a question of progress and where we go.
Dean, actually, that just reminds me, I suppose, in the court case that you mentioned, there's a few southern states that are particularly, you wouldn't say, are gay-friendly in any way.
Sorry, southern where?
Southern states, I think.
Of the US.
Louisiana. Arkansas. Mm. Yep.
So I guess that just brings me to, I suppose, Pat's point that is there perhaps needing to be a slightly broader term? You know, obviously it's easier to focus on gay marriage as an indicator, but is there some good sites or anything like that where there's a sort of a broader range of acceptance? And yeah, that's sort of, I guess, where I'm coming from. Is there any advice you'd have on that?
Well, in the States, it's very much baby steps. So they've had to focus on same-sex marriage at this point, and it's more about constitutional rights. So in the United States, they've argued that it's unconstitutional for couples of the same sex to be, how can I put it? Disadvantaged discriminated, but also disadvantaged. At this stage, I think that there certainly would be scope for it to be broadened in the future. Yeah, so it include intersex people and you know, transitioning people and all that sort of thing. But at the moment, that's as far as they can go.
And things like adoption rights and onto other broader issues, I
that's
guess.
That's definitely it as well.
Mm. What about Russia? I mean, because I know obviously that was
Russia.
Yeah. In the media a lot around the
You've
Olympics.
Thrown him in it now, Steph.
They better not be listening to this in Russia because of all that homosexual propaganda.
You'll go to jail, Steph.
That's it.
Oh, dear.
Yep.
Hopefully Tony Abbott will protect me. That was quite hard to say with my tongue in my cheek. So I guess my question is, so what's been, I mean, obviously the spotlight's gone off Russia to a certain extent since the Olympics. What's been happening since then?
Well, Russia's an interesting country because a lot of people in Russia don't, from what I've read and what I've heard about Russia, and is that people on the ground aren't too concerned about homosexuality per se. It's more about having to actually acknowledge that it exists and seeing it. Mm. That's where it comes from. So there are gay clubs in Moscow and St. Petersburg and, you know, Vladivostok and things like that.
St. Petersburg used to be the famous gay capital, actually.
I believe so, yeah. I mean, you know, I believe in the early 90s. In fact, I have vague memories. It was you know, there was a lot of porn coming out of Eastern Europe. So, you know, it was just, it was very, you know, it was much more gay friendly than it is now. But there are political reasons for this as well. If you want to shore up your support and you're a conservative, it's pretty easy to hide behind religion and say, you know, traditional family values and so on and so forth. Things are not good in Russia at the moment. The gay propaganda law has had a negative impact, but it
has been picked up in a number of the other former Soviet Union countries that are now members of the community of independent states, as they call their common market.
So-called independent states. The other thing is that the West has played into their hands by disputing the new changes and sort of arguing that they're inhumane and unconstitutional and undemocratic. That's exactly what Putin wants. He wants people from the West to say that's disgraceful, so he can do some saber rattling and say we don't want those Yanks telling us what to do and who do they think they are. It you know, it's basically what he wants.
That's always a challenge though, because what else would you advise the West to do in that instance, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, you do wonder, sort of, wouldn't he have bigger fish to fry? But it's a great distraction. If you look at the history of you know, gay and lesbian life, we've been wonderful scapegoats for any number of cultures for thousands of years. We're great to hide behind because ultimately we're harmless. We're not going to change society. There's no gay group that petitions churches and say that they should be shut down or tries to prevent straight people from being married.
Yes, I signed a petition the other day to say that the Bible should be banned because it's a violent anti-women book.
But you don't protest at soldiers' funerals and say that, you know, they should all go to hell or anything like that.
That's a good idea. I might start doing so.
Get some tips from the Phelps, you know. from Reverend Fred Phelps, then.
If there was someone, Jim, might potentially be a contender.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
You have been listening to Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9, and that's it. That's the end of the show for tonight. We've had a big show. Thanks, Clovis Palmer from the Burnand Institute. Thanks, Ian Muchmore from Living Positive Victoria. Thanks, Dean Galloway from Worldwide Wave. Thank you, Steph.
Thanks,
you, James.
Jim.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thanks, Joysters.
Thank you, Joysters. And we will see you next week with another big, big show.
Woohoo! Good night!
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.